check to then confirm that indeed we have achieved that insofar as the leading by example is concerned. The second aspect of leading by example.
Well, maybe we should interject here that point and say congratulations. I think that that is a very critical aspect, that that office is actually seen to be leading by example, as you put it. Yeah, what are that?
Thanks indeed, Chair. The second aspect of that leading by example is that of a transformation. And in this respect, there are two angles in which we have a touch on transformation, as will be evident in the detailed presentation today or this morning, is the manner in which with which we deal with our own employment equity issues within the office, of which the targets that we have set for ourselves have been achieved, if not surpassed, and also the extent to which we deal with transformation with regard to the profession at large, in terms of how we empower the firms that we work with primarily, because that's our biggest procurement area, so that they too can help in the improvement of the production of accountants and auditors and professionals in that field in the broader society. So with regard to both of these, we have reported a situation where we have lived up to the targets that we had set for ourselves. But the details will be in the detailed presentation that the DAG will help us with. The second area of focus is that of the funding model. I'm just doing it, Chair, bottom up. Funding model is one of the areas which we had gone into 2008-2009 limping, because last year we reported a major deficit because of a funding model that was inappropriate for the kind of business that we're running. But we're fortunate that based on last year's deliberations with SCOWEC, we have found a solution to that dilemma, and we have started implementing that solution. So this result will show partly the benefits of implementing the funding model in its new form. So we will still be reporting a deficit, but it will be a deficit that would have been reduced significantly because of the injection that we had were able to get from the eroded margins that were evident for the past, I think, 4 to 5 years. So the results will show that, and the details as the DAG will take us through will indicate the specific quantum of how we have begun to see early signs of a working and more appropriate funding model for the organization. Part of that strategy would look into the third area, which I'm going upwards, strengthening of human resource strategies. As part of these human resource strategies, the ability for us to operate effectively talks to two basic parameters. The one is how we exercise and do our audit work effectively, with people that have got know-how and people that are properly trained and people that are properly positioned in terms of levels of experience. And in this respect, we have shown a situation where there's been an improvement in the stability of the turnover of labor or skills within the office, which is another element that has got a lot of influence on the funding model in terms of the amount of margin that we are able to generate. The second element of human resource development is the extent to which we leverage on the on growing our own trees through the trainee accountant scheme, because the accounting skills and auditing skills are so scarce that unless we develop our own, the ability to sustain the skills that we need through recruiting them in the market is not going to be working well for us. And therefore, the focus on the traineeship, trainee accounting scheme is very, very critical for us. And the fact that that scheme is now stabilized at close to, I suppose, 1,000 or so, which is about close to half of our establishment, is something that is very pleasing for us, because then that is the pool from which we can then grow the managers and leadership that we need within the organization. So that is a very strategic platform for us to sustain the adequate and the ideal human resource profile that we need in the office. So I just want to draw the attention of the committee to that and how we've then performed against that, and the kind of numbers and the commitments, money-wise and leadership-wise, to make that scheme to work effectively. So in a nutshell, that one is can be looked at in two ways: the strengthening of the traineeship scheme as the main anchor to make that a success, because without that scheme, everything else is very unsustainable. But secondly, how then we use that scheme as a basis of having the right margins and funding for carrying out our work. Now, Chair, the last two, top two areas of focus, we also have commented about them in the report, and these are the ones that talk directly to the core of our business, which is auditing in government. And in this respect, we have demonstrated to what extent we have looked at the issue of visibility of leadership, and what has been happening this week in Parliament is one example of that, and what will be happening throughout the month of October is another example of the amount of visibility we need to show in order to create awareness about issues that need to be respected in order for our governance to be strengthened in South Africa. We have realized that unless we begin to act likewise, these issues could be misunderstood, these issues could perhaps be taken lightly, and we need to take a lead in getting people to be aware of what to be acted upon, and for these messages not to be misinterpreted. The other element of this visibility extends not only to the time of reporting our results, but in between reporting our results, how do we keep government informed, how do we keep government aware of the adherence to the practices that will deliver good results at the end. So we have started on this, for instance, in local government, where there have been door-to-door campaigns where we visited up to now four provinces, and we've been to each and every door of every municipality in Limpopo, in Mpumalanga, in the Western Cape and Gauteng. And we'll be proceeding with that initiative going into the next 2 years to wrap up all the municipalities. And with that, the expectation is that the rest of the leadership, because that's what I had to do personally, the rest of the leadership should then sustain that engagement, so that the mayors, executive mayors, councillors remain confident and committed to taking ownership of the good practices that will yield confidence when it comes to the effective use of government funding. So that's where we position leadership and visibility, and there are elements of that have been demonstrated in this report during the past year. But more of that will be more visible in the future annual report, because it's something that we have just started at the time of the 2008-2009 reporting cycle. Simplicity and clarity and relevance of our report is what is intertwined with leadership visibility, because it's about, first and foremost, not being visible, but being clear about the messages we carry when we go there. And it's important that there is consistency between what we say when we engage with the leadership and what is contained in our report. Because action will, in most instances, be influenced by what remains behind, after we had discussed, after we had had a dialogue like we had yesterday. I think it's important that those messages are very simple, they're very clear, they're very relevant, and compelling for action to be taken by the leadership of those charged with governance, because we are not charged with governance of government. We're simply an assurance provider. And those, for those that are charged with governance, do deserve to have something that is meaningful and clear and straightforward and touching on the root of the issues at hand, not symptoms. Because if you start talking about symptoms, we can go around in circles and never achieve anything. And perhaps if that could be understood, that would take us a long way to achieving the mandate of this organization. And Chair, this is where, in this respect, the correlation and alignment between this annual report and the general report that we put together is important. And in this report, we have tried to summarize in hopefully a comprehensive manner everything that we have reported on in the general report, including all the regularity audit reports, all the investigations that would have been in progress, all the performance audits, so that there's no difference of messages between our annual report and the general report. And it's something that we also can thank the previous SCOEC for having pointed out to us, and we are trying by all means to create that alignment. So, Chair, that in a sense is a composition of what would be contained in the detailed annual report that was tabled in Parliament, as well as a summary of the slide presentation that is scheduled for today. It's quite a number of slides, and perhaps we can be guided by you, Chair, as to how much detail we need to go through, with the understanding that the report was tabled somewhere in the middle of August, and by now the members would have had an opportunity to go through it almost cover to cover. And perhaps we are more than willing to respond to specific inquiries rather than perhaps going through the detailed presentation. But Chair, you guide us.
Yeah, before I answer that that question, I just wanted to emphasize the point that you've just made now, which is drawing the distinction between the general report and the annual report, because that is the point where you separate the two words in the Constitution. The word that says that Chapter 9 institutions, including the Auditor General, one must report to Parliament, and then two is accountable, must report to Parliament at least once a year, and then two is accountable to Parliament. So your annual report is the accountable part of that statement, and the general report is the reporting part of that statement to Parliament. And what we are about is the accountable part, which arises out of the report. Just to emphasize that point. But going back to your request for guidance, what we would want to do is to entertain high-level input at this stage, but tempered with elements, whether they are anecdotal or not, that basically illustrates or put emphasis where it's appropriate. So the extent of detail should really be based on those areas where you feel need emphasis, and the examples that are specific, if they would assist in that regard, you know, that should be the guiding principle. Thank you. Mr. Steele?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd just like to record also my congratulations to the AG's department for their clean audit, as you've done already. I think that would be appropriate, and also to say how important that is, because it reflects ultimately on the credibility of all of the audits the AG department conducts, and because his department has a clean audit, that gives credibility to all of the audit outcomes. Chair, I think we should also note the AG's point that he has made, that he is not the executive authority. He is the Auditor General, and he is not ultimately accountable for the audit outcomes insofar as implementing decisions by the executive authorities. He can merely report on his findings, but he is not the person or the agency that's responsible for actually acting within those departments.
I think you would notice that the committee of chairpersons set yesterday to receive the general report from the Auditor General, and those issues arose there in terms of how do you take the issues arising out of the audit outcomes forward as part of your oversight function, both at the level of the legislative but also at the level of the executive. A small point that arose yesterday also related to the manner of presentation and the forum, I suppose, of presentation, official or initial presentation of the audit outcomes. You know, with the budget, the Minister of Finance will have this special day where Parliament is laced with all the beautiful flowers and so on, and will make his official announcement of the budget. We don't have that kind of thing in the House insofar as the Auditor General's report, general report, which has a very important role to play, to say, having given you out the money, how has the money been spent? So I think that Parliament going forward is going to have to explore ways of best creating a platform that would best allow for the formalization of that kind of introduction of the Auditor General's report. But I suppose it's part of the institutional developments. I think we would need to look at jurisdictions elsewhere as well and see whether there are better ways of doing that. But are there any other comments, Honorable Zebe?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just wanted to congratulate the AG's office for good work well done in terms of the performance of the office itself. We have seen it last 2 weeks in terms of the findings to the SABC, what happened. Really, it paved a way for the interim board of the SABC to do their work properly, because they were guided by the AG's report in terms of what is happening in the department. But maybe, Honorable Chair, just maybe 2 or 3 things that I would like maybe the AG to assist in terms of clarity. The relations in regard to this new strategy from the Department of the COCTA. They've just launched a clean audit program. I just want to be assured in terms of the participation that this office will take in regard to make sure that it will be indeed a reality. Because in my mind, I think your office must play a critical role, because you are the ones who are dealing with those audit in assisting the department. So I just want you to be sure, what role are you going to play in this program of the clean audit by the Department of the Corporate Governance? The other thing, Honorable Chair, is on the issue of capacity. In most cases, when you receive this Auditor General's report, there's a lot of capacity. I think capacity can mean many things. I just want the Auditor General to unpack that capacity. When they say lack of, in most cases, you attend the hearings from the Department of Cooperative Governance, especially in regard to municipalities, you'll be told that the lack of capacity, there's no capacity. What kind of capacity? Are we referring to skills or we just have people there who are not just doing their job. Lastly, in regard to our funding model, maybe if just briefly the source of the funding. And the last meeting I attended, briefing by the Auditor General, there was something like, in some instances, the office experienced a non-payment by other institutions, either municipalities or departments, maybe timely or non-payment. Does this model try to address that? Maybe the recovery strategy of them, the money's owned to the AG's office. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Just before Mr. George, just want to indicate that it may well be that some of the questions will be addressed as the AG zooms into a specific area. But I leave the discretion to him whether he would want to react to some of those issues instantly or would want to integrate them in his response. Mr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to echo the sentiments of my colleague in congratulating the Auditor General on the outcome of the audit. I certainly wish that other departments could follow suit. I know that you're going to be drilling into further detail, and I'll hold my questions for there. But specifically, you mentioned the model, the funding model for the office, and it is clearly written in here about your debt collection. It's deteriorating, not everywhere, but it certainly isn't looking very good. I would like to know exactly what steps are being taken to resolve this, because it should be fairly easy to resolve, given that government departments must pay for the service. They're just not paying for it. So what concrete steps are actually being taken? Thanks, Chair.
That's the full suite of the first go at your initial overview. Would you like to respond?
Yes, Chair, I'm going to defer the question on the funding model and the actions being taken to the detailed discussion when we get to that point, because it's important that we explore it quite elaborately. I'll just respond to the link and relationship with the Department of Cooperative Governance and the issue of capacity, because both issues, they reside in our first two priorities, which is the manner by which we communicate our information and how we then act on that by way of our own visibility and continued support. We have been part of the engagements with that department, and the launch that took place in Gauteng was informed by our review of the need for that, and in engaging with the minister, I would like to believe that the determination of 2014 was based on a realistic assessment of the state of readiness of the municipalities. Naturally, some of the municipalities can achieve those clean audits much earlier, but some will require much more injection in terms of attention by leadership to get there. Hence, a much more extended timeline for that to 2014, but it is achievable. It will need to be nurtured, it will need to be managed very closely, and as part of our leadership visibility and simplicity of our messages, we'll be doing that. Capacity is an issue that has got someone employed to deal with. In any situation, a leader in an institution is employed to deal with capacity issues. So when people talk about capacity, it means someone who is employed to address the capacity issues is not doing that job. And leadership is put in these places in order to make sure that human resource challenges are dealt with, technological challenges, if they are there, they are dealt with, and also identifying, providing leadership as to what alternatives or workarounds could be considered in the event of a serious constraint to deal with the obvious available resources. So it's not something that can be used as a reason for not performance. Thank you, Chair.
Can I also just mention that one of the points I made when Minister Chikeka presented his launch of the clean audit was to take us back to Chapter 9 of the Constitution, which says that other organs of state must assist Chapter 9 institutions in order to enable them to be effective in discharging their constitutional mandates. And to say that what his department is doing is actually living up to that constitutional injunction. And I think the challenge would be for the rest of us who are organs of state, as mentioned in Chapter 9, to live up to that injunction, to make sure that in whatever we do, we contribute towards ensuring that Chapter 9 institutions, in this case the Auditor General's office, is actually effective. And that's why the meeting of committees yesterday went into certain very key strategic and significant issues to say, if we have recurring problems, be they of capacity or qualified reports, etc., all right, what is it that we are doing as an institution, as Parliament? And to ask the same questions to our own colleagues in the executive to say, what is it that we are doing from both sides of the fence in the face of some of these recurring problems? So I think this is something that we're going to be preoccupied for quite significantly for the next month and years as this institution as well. I just wanted to emphasize that point at this stage. Please proceed with the rest of the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps I can hand over to Kimi to take us through the highlights of the successes and challenges that we have reflected in the annual report.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to highlight some of the significant aspects of what's contained in our annual report. As the AG has initially indicated, we tabled this report in August, and all we've done in putting together this presentation was to extract as best we can the areas that we believe are going to require the notice and the attention of the committee without necessarily excluding anything else that is contained in our annual report. So in essence, whatever is in our annual report, we will be ready to engage with it. So effectively what we have in this presentation, which spans about 40 pages of presentation, I'm going to go through it in possibly no more than an hour so that we can get a gist of some of the issues that we need to highlight. If I look at the table of contents page, the way we structured the report, we felt that we should follow the five areas of focus that the AG has spoken to, which are, among others, the area around the core work that we do as an office, which is areas of simplicity, visibility of leadership, the human resource efforts that we put into this organization, the funding of this organization, as well as leadership perspective around matters of governance and financial administration. So I'm going to focus on those key issues because that's effectively what we committed to do during the 08-09 year when we submitted the strategic plan the year before. Obviously, the overview page I'm going to skip. The AG has already spoken to that. I think that it is sufficient to reinforce the message that all of the resources that we get through our audits at the office are predominantly geared around driving achievement of the commitments that the AG has spoken about. If there's anything else that we spend our resources on outside of these commitments, it is not a matter that is significant. Focusing on the highlights for the past financial year, I think again consistent with the issue around the product, which is the auditing and reporting on the accounts of government, there's been quite a huge focus around communicating our audit report outcomes, as well as engaging all the stakeholders throughout the country to share with them what it is that is contained in their reports and what are the actions that they need to be taking from an oversight point of view. So we believe that we have given sufficient focus to that area. However, the road ahead, as members would have experienced through the engagement yesterday, there's still a greater focus that needs to be given to this so that we can at least enjoy the benefits of the work that we are doing in the future. We've also noted in our annual report that in terms of our own performance as an organization, we have not compromised the quality standards that have become to be associated with an office of our kind. And I'm going to go into the detail of that in the slides in terms of what it is we've achieved. The system that we are responsible for doing audit work in with respect to the prescripts of the PFMA as well as the MFMA, there's been substantial improvements with respect to the timely submission of information by both national, provincial departments as well as municipalities, and the AG has made reference to this issue. So it is clear that a lot of institutions, if one looks back 5 years, have really turned the corner with regard to at least ensuring that the financial information that needs to be subjected to audit is submitted on time. And in terms of our own mandate, we've also responded by producing the reports within the prescribed deadlines according to the PFMA and the MFMA, in the sense that we have achieved close to the 90% age in respect of that. On the people side, the focus in the past year, and I think it's a major highlight, it has been around attracting talent and best-of-breed talent, I must say. We've now decided that it is no longer about the numbers of accountants that we attract, but the quality aspects as well as the talent of the people that we attract is one of the key important issues, because that talks to the level of quality that we are able to sustain in the work that we do. I'll deal with that in terms of the vacancies as well, because we have highlighted that before, and we believe that on all of the human resource-related initiatives, there are significant successes that the office has recorded. And then the last point, I think, around the highlights is also our global outreach program, which is a network of auditors general in the world that we plug into, among other things, to also learn the best practices that happen globally as well as in the continent. And I think the issue that we are highlighting as one of the key highlights here is a conference of the Supreme Audit Institutions in the continent that we hosted during October of last year, which also is a significant milestone for the office to have hosted in the country a number of auditors general from the continent and learned from them, and we also shared our expertise with them. Now, the first chapter is, as I've indicated, on our strat plan as well as our statement of commitment is within the area of simplicity and clarity of our reports. And certainly, I think one of the key achievements to note here is that the whole area of communicating our audit outcomes simply and clearly is really one of the central issues to the realization of our constitutional mandate. And we believe that we have started doing that in the form of the door-to-door visits the AG spoke about, in the form of the commitments that we have been getting from the executive, from the legislatures, in terms of what it is that they will assume responsibility for. So we think that that is working. We think that it is going in the right direction. However, there are a number of things that we still need to build in terms of ensuring that our own people who are driving leadership in the office are continuously geared towards assisting our auditees. The other area in this space on the issue of the audits is the development of performance audit capability. There's no doubt that service delivery and the audits of service delivery with respect to commenting on economy, on efficiency and effectiveness of the utilization of resources, as it is clearly articulated in the Constitution, is one area that we are gearing ourselves for. We haven't done a significant amount of work in this area. We have taken a double-pronged approach, which is to do the bare minimum that we can handle at this stage, but in the background, to start focusing on building our own skills so that we can be able to comment and to be able to reflect on issues of performance auditing. So that is an ongoing area. Another one in this area, we also have responsibility on the international front to audit the books of the United Nations agencies, which we do together with two other countries that are part of the United Nations Board of Auditors. It's ourselves, China and France, who are responsible for this UN body of audits. In that area, we've also gained significant ground in the sense that our own people, when we attract them into the office, it's one of those things that we flag as a potential opportunity for them to have exposure on the international front. But again, in terms of the work that we do, it is another significant area where we respond to some of the prescripts that are set out by the United Nations in terms of its own rules on finance and all of that. And then lastly in this area, the tabling to Parliament of our reports has been an ongoing issue. We have not deviated from that. And we have, from the point of view of performance audits, tabled about 38 performance audit reports. Among them are the reports that were engaged in Parliament recently with regard to the N2 Gateway, among others, and various others pertaining to the conflict of interest report and all of that. So that's effectively those issues from a core deliverables point of view that we have been doing in the past year. Just quickly on the quality assurance results. In this area, we engage the services of the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, who are our service providers, because they are the regulator in the country. They are the ones who do generally quality assurance with regard to even private audit firms. And the results that we achieved this year, we believe, were something that we have not seen before in terms of the excellent results that we achieved from the work that our senior managers are doing in the different departments and provinces. Many of them got ratings that reflected that we are improving. It is the place that we want to be. And you will note in the same slide that we did not want to have any outcome that is reflecting as poor, even though that it is below 10% in terms of the poor outcomes. We have taken the necessary steps to do the necessary counseling and corrective action with regard to those people who were found to have slipped with regard to the performance on a quality front. So there's two issues here. One is the continuous improvement on a year-by-year basis, as well as our readiness to engage and deal with any challenges that arise.
Chair, sorry, I need to interrupt here. Is that slide actually correct where it says results of category poor show improvement? Shouldn't that be good?
It is correct because poor is lower than any other year before.
It's still an improvement.
It's an improvement because the poor results of 2008 were around 10%. 2007 were between 10 and 20. 2006 was close to 20. The current year is below 10%. So I guess what it means is that the people that perform poorly are getting smaller and smaller, which means it's an improvement. Then on the issue of the On the issue of our timeliness of results, I think the comment that's worth making here, and this detail is directly extracted from the annual report, but I think it's important to say that the achievement of the timeliness results for PFMA and MFMA, from our point of view, is that it enables the system of government to at least have enhanced capacity to exercise oversight over the entities that we audit. In the sense that where we achieve 99% delivery in terms of the completion of our audit in accordance with statutory deadlines, what it means for us is that the portfolio committees and the Standing Committee on Public Accounts are now able to deal with whatever oversight matters they need to deal with based on information that is current, that is relevant, and that is up to date. So this is a very important milestone because it is saying to us, in the system of oversight, there are no departments or entities that have a substantial number of years backlog, in which case they are not able to be dealt with immediately in terms of areas where they've slipped up. So we believe this is something that is going in the right direction, and I'm not too sure to what extent we are able to maintain this percentage, because it is a high percentage. We hope that the numbers that we are seeing coming through even now are going to be in the 90s going forward. As I said, on the issue of performance audits, I think what I want to indicate here is that we are in the building phase with regard to the issue of performance audits, and that there's...
Maybe before you proceed, by way of highlighting, because I think we said where there may be a need to give more detail for the sake of emphasis, I'm curious to know what you attribute that high level of compliance to in terms of improvement there.
On the previous slide?
Yeah. Because you seem to be worried whether you can sustain it going forward. I mean, it's good to be on a high note, but the challenge is, how sustainable is it? What are the structural or concrete arrangements that would sustain that high level of performance?
Chair, if you look at it in a number of years ago, a lot of these entities had started off, for example, where most of these departments or municipalities, for that matter, were coming out of a phase of amalgamation with a number of administrations that were there in the country before. And therefore, if you looked at consolidating the accounts of municipalities in the Eastern Cape, you were dealing with legacy issues over a period of time. A lot of those legacy issues have now come out, and we're basically dealing with a sustained response to the stability that is coming about as a result of clarity provided with respect to the PFMA. So the issues of compliance to those deadlines are part of what we do with respect to our visibility. When we communicate with our audit steering committees, when we communicate with our accounting officers, we emphasize the issue of them having to adhere to these deadlines. So if anything, it may well be that if they slip back from these percentages, it might be a case of, for example, in the future, if there were to be significant vacancies in some of the major departments where there are no people to do this job. But I think it's a legacy that has come out of the system. That's what we've observed.
Can I also urge colleagues that if there is a particular area, you don't have to wait to the end to ask questions, that you want further elaboration that fascinates, you should feel free to interject. Because we're moving from the premise that we're doing a high-level presentation and they wouldn't know where you are particularly wanting to get more detail. Maybe we could use that approach rather. Okay, proceed.
All right. Thank you. This slide here on the quality I've already spoken to, it's one of those where we had said, in terms of these ratings, for example, if you look at the quality, we had a target for 2008-09, and we are comparing that to our actual performance. As I indicated earlier, our target is always to have zero under poor performance. And of course, the reality is that we're now sitting at about 7%. But as I said, the only thing that needs to be highlighted here is that we are taking the necessary actions. And these actions that we take involve having to have disciplinary engagements with those people that get poor performance, and to also remove the privilege for them to sign off on reports if there's a continuous pattern of this behavior, until such time that we ask them to leave the organization if we believe that they are not showing any improvement. And the rest of it is really around the timeliness, which we've already spoken about. And in terms of the product element, that's, I think, sufficient to highlight.
Just on the earlier slide, in terms of, is that in relation to the various entities and the people in those entities, are you referring to the AG's office?
You're referring to our people.
This is
about our own people's performance in relation to the quality work they do for the audits that we are responsible for. Because we've got certain standards that are determined in accordance with our international standards on auditing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a standard that says that you need to accumulate sufficient audit evidence to support the conclusions that we reach on our audits, if when the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors goes in and pick up a file of a senior manager, and in that file they pick up that there are gaps and there's no proper documentation of what that evidence is which supports the conclusion, then that will be classified as performing at a level lower than what the standard requires. So this is a reflection on our own people.
Yeah. This comes across as leadership by example and fitting in with one of your, what did you call them, the five key...
Commitments.
But I just wanted to say that maybe we should have a system where if you have reported previously on problems arising out of an entity, how do future reports follow up on whether action was in fact taken by the respective entity to correct that problem or not, so that as public representatives were able to not only see a recurrence of a problem, but to also see a recurrence of non-action to rectify the problem. Because to me, that is more important than the mere reporting that there is a recurrence. I don't know if the general report, you would say, is actually able to zoom into that in any specific terms.
Chair, in terms of the general report now, as you indicated, what we put in the general report is an area which indicates issues that were previously reported where no action has been taken. But we've engaged with this issue and said to ourselves, maybe there's a need to do a further analysis on this issue so that we can highlight and classify the type of issues that are recurring which are not receiving attention, and find a way of escalating them to the respective structures. For example, if we have a classification that says category A, category B, category C, if category A, for example, is a very significant risk that if it is not addressed might result in the audit outcome of a particular department becoming either a disclaimer or an adverse, we are busy now doing some research in the background to say what is the level of escalation that category must go to, so that if it goes to that level of escalation, it is absolutely clear to those people who are receiving a category A report that if they don't act on it, then it means that they will also be accountable for the reversal of the audit outcomes. So we're busy working on that issue to make sure that we give substance to the issue of non-action with respect to previously reported items. So we haven't really positioned it yet in the general report for this year, but I suspect that in the next year and going forward, we would have formulated a plan around it. We've taken a model which is used, among others, also in some big private sector organizations, where escalations, once they go to, let's say, the board of an organization, it means that if it's escalated at that level, it is so serious that nobody can not do anything about it. So we're busy working on a model around that, and the head of audit is leading that area in the office. And I'm sure in the next year or so, we will be able to share with the committee what our view with respect to that is.
We'll certainly monitor that and actually follow up on that, because that may just be one of the most effective tools that could bring a stop or an end to this recurrent issue. Because unless we are able to track corrective measures and the extent of those corrective measures, then we might a little bit be depriving ourselves of the most effective way of bringing the problem to finality, so to speak. But all right.
Then on the chapter regarding the visibility of leadership, and I'm going to fly through this one very quickly. We have engaged, as we said earlier, with media, and we are going to continue doing that with the roadshow that we are currently busy with in terms of the PFMA. Another area which we've driven on our side and have reflected on it as part of our quality management process is around driving performance culture in the organization. That's the time we spent in the beginning of this, towards the end of this financial year, was to begin to elevate for all our staff the things that matter for our organization, among others, the mission, the vision, and the values that we subscribe to as an office. And this is part and parcel of not just being visible outside in terms of the outcomes that we communicate, but we are also saying we need our people to understand and to live by the values and the mission of the office. And that's one of the things that in the visibility of leadership program we have been spending a lot of time on. With regards to other Chapter 9 institutions, we are also continuing to develop memoranda of understanding, and we finalized two thus far with the Public Protector and the Office of the Public Service Commission. There are a number of others that are in the pipeline which we are busy working on, and the idea is to start working closely with other Chapter 9 institutions so that as a peer group of institutions that fall within Chapter 9 of the Constitution, that if there are things that they are working on, we need to be comparing notes on a regular basis and to start finding common areas of interest. So that is an ongoing area. We haven't really implemented those MOUs that we have signed, but I think we are happy that we signed them, and we recognize that they don't belong in the shelf. They belong in the area where action must be taken around them. I did engage and share with the committee the issue around our global outreach, and I think it is one of those areas where in the future it will help us to ensure that the South African auditing approach is aligned to what our other auditors general are about in the rest of the world. This is a slide, Chair, just to highlight the efforts that we've put into influencing what is happening in the area of the PFMA audit. This is a presentation that was done in 2008 with regard to the classification of audit outcomes. Our committee members who were in the committee yesterday would have seen the bulk of this, but it's just one of those that we are demonstrating for purposes of this presentation to say that when we talk about audit outcomes, these are the issues that we are highlighting. I'm not going to go to the detail of this because it was engaged with yesterday, and the roadshows that we're going to be doing are going to be about this particular information. And this information is geared, as we said also yesterday, to enlighten the executive in government in general, as well as the people charged with oversight on what level of progress is being achieved with regard to the state of financial management in government, as well as what initiatives and commitments should be made in order to ensure that the right culture is created in terms of financial management. So when we talk about visibility, we're talking about going out into the system and sharing this information. And this is exactly the same in terms of this NetOne. Even though we have cracked the issue of submission, I think it's still important to reflect on the fact that we still are bothered and worried about the level of quality sometimes that we receive. If you refer to the slide that I presented earlier, where in some instances we are achieving 89% and 90% of submission, this timely submission sometimes also comes with some quality challenges. And these quality challenges, we see them when we elevate the level of material misstatements that need to be adjusted during the course of the audit. So I think it is one thing to get a high prevalence of submission in terms of the timely submission, but sometimes those come with a lot of issues that need to be corrected during the course of the audit. We believe that it's a challenge, and that's what one of the initiatives of our visibility program is about. And so I think we need to make sure that there's always a balance between putting information in time as well as the quality to which that information can be tested.
Can you put some emphasis on the role of internal audit committees at this juncture? Because my assumption is that unlike yourself, who only come at the end of the year, after all is said and done, they are there throughout. Is it because we're not having enough of those audit committees in the institutions, or that those audit committees are not sufficiently capable, or even raise the issue of capacity, or where exactly is the underlying problem there? Because I would have imagined the purpose of their being there is precisely to avert problems such as that one in particular.
To the extent that regular production of financial statements is not an entrenched practice, even audit committees themselves, for example, if an audit committee sits in February and they look at information of a particular auditee, in the absence of annual or financial statements, let's say for the first 6 months, they will be in no better position at the end of the year when they see that financial information for the first time. And that's why the AG, among others, has also emphasized the need to focus on the regular production of annual of financial information, the monthly reporting of financial information, because it will put the audit committee in a better position if the audit committee were to have sight of quarterly information of the department, so that by the time they are building up their work towards the end of the financial year, at least they know where the holes are. Take an example with the suspense account. If I'm an audit committee member and I come across a suspense account at the end of the financial year, which has not been managed throughout the year, it'll make the work of the audit committee less effective if I see that suspense account for the first time, because it might be an accumulation of problems that the department has been having over a long period of time. And the audit committee, because they are a non-executive to the department, may be challenged because they can't say that this issue was there in March, it was there in June, it was there in September, because they are seeing it for the first time when they are trying to approve the annual financial statements. But I think the point you are making about the role of audit committees is valid, Chair, but to the extent that it works in tandem with the regular production of financial information, that's, I think, where the gap is at the moment.
That raises another important question, and that is, do the audit committees have powers? What exactly is their mandate? Can they demand things? And what happens if they demand things and those things are not forthcoming? Can they demand that particular procedure be put in place? And what happens if that does not happen? In other words, I'm trying to capture the problem before it even reaches the stage of the Auditor General's intervention.
let alone Parliament, let alone anybody else who has an oversight function. And maybe it goes to asking the question, have these audit committees been well-positioned? Has their mandate been clearly defined? How far can they go in terms of enforcing compliance within a department, being audit committees, and therefore expected to actually nip the problem in the bud, so to speak. So maybe it's because I do not know enough about how audit committees are constituted and what their role is. But I would have thought the very purpose of creating them is to be able to make an intervention well early enough so that corrective measures do not wait until the end of the financial year.
Yes, Chair, perhaps I can also respond to that one. The gap that we've seen is in line with your observation. In most instances, the audit committees are required to be appointed by the executive authority. I think that's what the PFMA requires. But what we have observed constantly, the fact that in most instances becomes the end of the responsibility of the executive authority. Beyond that, the audit committee seldom ever have any engagement, any interface with the executive authority. And in that instance, it then defeats the purpose of the executive authority having an objective expert body that will assure him or her that things are managed within acceptable norms. So you're right, in terms of streamlining and perhaps looking at their terms of reference, that's an aspect that needs to be looked at in with a sharper focus. Who they are accountable to and about what do they engage with the executive authority. At a local government level, with these door-to-door sessions, it has been quite enlightening to realize the extent to which that omission is glaring. And most of the executive mayors and councillors that we have spoken to in the four provinces have now warmed up to the reality that they need to utilize that avenue. But the first intervention is to appoint audit committees that are experts in the field of audit committee work. And then the interaction with them has got to also be streamlined so that things can be caught before they become a problem at the end of the audit. So what needs to be done in that respect, yeah.
You see, my feeling is that this exercise should not just be a flow. We should be able to pick up the sticky areas, crystallize them, contextualize them, so that they become the point around which we then are able to make recommendations. Because I don't want to present a report to the House that basically says that SCOAC looked at the annual report and is happy with this and becomes a nice party, and then we all go home. I want it to also serve as a tool to identify fault lines in the system itself and the way it's designed, so that even if we have to propose legislative reforms, such that certain institutions are empowered to effectively do their work, that they're able to do that. So let's keep on picking on some of this kind of fault lines, if you like, and put emphasis on them, because that's where I think most of the solutions to the problems, underlying problems, are going to be found. All right.
And just in terms of the summary of our performance against targets, we, in terms of the visibility side of things, set ourselves milestones for the year, which, as we have reflected in the annual report and as has been audited and reviewed by our auditors, we believe that we have achieved the targeted milestones with respect to the areas that I've highlighted under the area of visibility of leadership. Then the next chapter, Chair, as we said, is the area of our human resources. I'm just going to focus primarily on the key initiatives and achievements from a
Chair, perhaps sorry, Kim, to interject.
Yes,
just to pick up on your suggested approach, I think this is a point at which we can now pause and say on those matters that have got to do with the core of our mandate, which is reporting to Parliament effectively, what are those matters that need to be lifted for incorporation into your response, attention, and action as a SCOWEC, and perhaps how should we as an office be part of that of that decision, because now we're going to move into an area which has got to do more with the administrative arrangements within the office.
Thanks for bringing that to our attention. Colleagues, I think that clearly thus far there are a number of strategic points at which we may want to zoom in and say, you know, let's pause and reflect and say, where are the problem areas? What possible improvements, either in the design of the system or on issues of implementation? Are there any specific points that colleagues want to raise? Honorable Steele?
Thank you, Chair. I have a question based on the performance audit reports, page 36 of the annual report. While the Deputy AG is talking about the successes of the performance audits, I'm just concerned about the dates that are given here for tabling and the fact that we haven't seen some of these reports that are dated September 2009, August 2009, September 2009. I'd just like to know what's happened to all of those and why we haven't started seeing them.
Could you clarify that?
Just to confirm if the reference is made to the national reports, because I've just scanned through most of them, and most of them all look, I suppose, familiar as having been tabled. Maybe there's some in September, but I'm sure we can give an indication. But those are the times by when they will be tabled. Certainly the field work has been finalized. It's just a question of when the report gets finalized and tabled, but some of them have indeed been tabled.
Are we referring to the...
Table 15 is
the text, yeah, of the report or of the slide?
No, Chair, I'm looking at the published annual report, and Table 15... Under the national departments, you've got a September 09 for forensic chemistry, you've got an August 2009 for ownerless mines. Table 16, you've got National Development Agency, August 2009. And then under the provincial departments, you've got a whole lot of September 2009 for investment in infrastructure. I'm just concerned because these are projected dates, but we've already passed these dates and we haven't seen these.
But this report actually came before those dates. It was actually tabled before the date. So these were the envisaged dates for tabling as opposed to actual dates. So I suppose the answer is to clarify as to which of those were eventually actually tabled on the envisaged date. I think that's the clarity. Is it something that you may want to verify later?
We'll come back to the committee and just provide that detail. As you said, Chair, this was written a number of months before these dates anyway, so it was planned to be done at this time. But if there were any delays, we'll share that as to when the actual date is going to be, if not yet tabled.
Yeah. Maybe you could just simply update the schedule, and that way basically we'd get to know which of those were eventually tabled and on which day.
Yeah. All right.
I'm sure your parliamentary office can easily liaise with the table office in Parliament.
Yeah.
AG wanted to say.
Just to confirm, Chair, that any of these reports that would have been tabled would appear in our website. So if it's not in our website, it would not have been tabled as yet. That's the latest up-to-date version of tablings are all in our website.
That includes yesterday's report.
Only the slides, but because yesterday was more of a dialogue than a report.
Yeah. Do we know a date when we could be anticipating that one?
We're looking at the end of October once we've finished the roadshows.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. In fact, maybe at that point, the earlier matter of how do you formally present as opposed to the tabling of the written report, how do you formally present the report before Parliament, maybe something which could have been dealt with so that by that time, we know if it will be possible to introduce a new approach where, you know, somebody will stand in the house and table, and then you are relieved of this concern that I had a bit of a wrangling yesterday, whether it's your job to name and shame or it's the politician's job to do that. And maybe such a platform would be an appropriate place to highlight which are the great performers, but on the same breath, which ones are the struggling ones, so that they know that if they don't strive towards maintaining a good image, you know, the negative image will be pronounced upon publicly. I think that was what the concern of the chairs were, to say it's not good enough for people to say, well, you'll find it in the report, but we should have a platform where we're able to say openly, so and so and so are the people who need to jack up their performance. But the question was, whose role is it? Is it the AG, or is it us, the politicians, who must stand up on the podium and say, and point fingers, you know, which I think is one of our major responsibilities. All right, colleagues, any further questions relating to the first presentation? AG?
Yes, I think it would be important to, as part of SCOWET, just flag that as a matter that needs to be looked into, because we will continue to engage. We will continue to dialogue with all the portfolio committees, all the executive members of the leadership, without being sensational about the issues, but by pointing out that needs to be dealt with, which is what we had attempted to do yesterday, because what's important is the issues at hand as opposed to the identity of the department. And therefore, for that to receive more credibility, how then should we structure this session so that there's no expectation raised that this is a naming and shaming exercise, because it is not and it will never be, and we're not going to be party to that game. Our job is to identify the issues that need to be resolved. Our job is not to sensationalize and embarrass or name and shame people or individuals. we've got a national responsibility to make sure that things are dealt with holistically, so that we are objective and in the way in which we deal with these issues, but we're not selective in the manner in which these issues are dealt with. And that's why we identified cross-cutting issues that we should be mindful of and make sure that those that perform in line with those issues remain in that space, and those that have not reached that space are attracted to that space. So that's the approach that we have chosen to adopt.
In any case, my interpretation, which I hope will find favor with the scholars of the Constitution, is that you are required as a Chapter 9 institution to report to Parliament. Now, once you have reported, your job is done. The Constitution assigns a totally different task to the legislature, and the legislature's role is to hold accountable. So once you've reported and the legislature now knows where the problem is, or for that matter, who the problems are, it's up to the legislature to then hold those that are problematic accountable, whether by way of, letting them walk the red carpet in SCOPA, or whether by people, members standing on the podium and pointing fingers at the offenders, at the transgressors. I mean, that's up to Parliament how it deems it best to discharge its task of holding accountable. That would be my strong view. Hence, I'm saying Parliament would have to explore how best to deal with the issue of formally presenting, the report, be it through a SCOPA or through an executive functionary coming and saying, I hear table before you, or present before you the report of the AG, and these are the highlights that come out of it, and these are some of the specific issues that Parliament would have to look at. All right, Mr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think also we mustn't lose sight of the fact that the role of this committee is to provide oversight to the Auditor General. And therefore, the Auditor General needs to do various things and reports back to this committee. Now, if various departments haven't been audited or cannot be audited or whatever the case is, then we need to know that. Because if we don't know that, then it appears to us as if the Auditor General is not doing their job. So I do think that we do need to get information timeously, that if reports for specific departments or audits for specific departments are getting into trouble, we need to know that, so that we know that the Auditor General cannot do its job. I think that's important. Thank you, Chair.
Perhaps that's a different matter, and I think we need to deal with it differently. And that is, to the extent that an issue relates specifically to our mandate, obviously our approach then is to be very crystal and very specific. Our mandate, amongst others, is to ensure the efficacy of the office of the AG. In fact, it's not only ours, it's not our mandate alone. As I said earlier, Chapter 9 enjoins all organs of state to assist, obviously within the context of their own mandate, the Auditor General's office to be effective in its job. But for us as SCOAC, that responsibility is even more specific, in that there is specific legislation that enjoins us to do certain things. Now, clearly, where the AG's office is encountering difficulties that inhibit it to be effective in its job of being able to report to Parliament on all entities because of certain problems, those should be brought forth
in very specific terms to the committee. That's how I would interpret the constitution. But on the basis that they constitute barriers for the AG's office to effectively discharge its mandate in the terms that you Mr. George, yourself stated. Maybe the AG's office can advise us on how they would find it best to present those kind of stumbling blocks to SCOWEC and the point at which they would deem it most appropriate to do so, so that we are of the same wavelength in that regard. Do you want to comment?
Yes, Chair, perhaps going forward, the possibilities are there, because we also have got a intention to get much more closer to these issues that you've highlighted as requiring attention, so that we are in a position to identify which departments, which ministries, which municipalities are adhering to the required norms, required expected governance habits that will breed, I suppose, ideal audit outcomes at the end, and an ideal audit outcome is a clean report. So as part of our database, we will have that information. But the one thing that we would continue to be reluctant to do is to parade that information in a public space in a manner that will defeat the purpose of this engagement. This engagement is meant to facilitate dialogue that will trigger the right action towards the audit outcomes. Now, if we make this a public parade, then I think we're going to defeat the purpose.
I think we have exhausted this point, because, and I'll give you an opportunity, Mr. Steele, because this issue has arisen yesterday, and clearly it was a sticky point. And I think that it we've reached a point where we must acknowledge as Parliament, as an institution, that it is an area that needs to be ring-fenced and around which we would need to go back to the drawing board in reviewing institutional arrangements of Parliament as an institution to say how best does Parliament address this issue. All right. Like I said, one way of doing it would be to leave it to political functionaries to make those pronouncements, as opposed to leave the responsibility with the AG's office itself. But Parliament may look at it differently and come with different solutions to the problem. But at least we need to identify it as a sticky issue, which is an institutional issue, that the institution as in Parliament would need to resolve on and find a way forward around. But Mr. Steele, you want to still have a take on this?
No, Chair, I just want to go back to the question that I asked, and I think the head of audit has been doing some research. He might have some information for us.
That's in relation to the date issue, the schedule. I thought we had resolved that. We'll get feedback on a later date once all information has been verified. Unless somebody wants us to depart from that decision. All right. Are there any other issues that members would want to zoom into arising out of this this presentation thus far? I would also like to I think I've just lost that one. Maybe let's proceed into the second part, and if there are issues that need to be revisited arising out of the second part, we can at a later stage come back to them. It will also save us some time. Maybe at this point let's proceed to that.
On the people side, as was reflected earlier in the area of commitment, Chair, I just want to highlight two or three issues around the human resource side. One is that we have noticed in comparing our industry average in terms of retention of staff, that we have put in a target of about 16%, which at the time that we put together the strat plan for the year that's just passed, it was sitting at about 16%. And our experience in terms of what the retention of staff level has been, in fact, the number of the turnover of staff is now sitting at about 11%, which means that over the last year we've been making some successes in retaining the talent that we need to keep in the office. Our task in respect of this is to make sure that we continue to provide them opportunities to grow and develop so that we can get them to the levels where they become our managers and leaders in the audit office. And the second issue, again, around staff is the whole area of the trainee accountants that AG also raised earlier, that this is the source of talent primarily for the office, and we believe that it does not help our cause if we've got somewhere around 900 trainee accountants at any one time. And once they've come through the system and passed and got through their third year, which is the final year of their training contract, that we lose them. And we are really putting a lot of effort into making sure that we can continue to recover the return on investment in terms of the training resources that we put into assisting young, emerging accounting talent to make sure that it becomes part of our environment. And the last point, which I think is a fairly recent initiative, and we spoke about it at length with the previous SCOWIC, is an initiative that we took to fill up the gaps with regards to the vacancies we've been experiencing at our management and assistant manager level within the audit environment. And that was to enter into an arrangement with one of the local firms, Deloitte, where we sourced some of the managerial skills from India. For example, we've got about 42 managers spread across the whole country who have assisted us in the delivery, and those contracts are based on a limited duration for their stay in South Africa. So we've got them for periods ranging between a year and 2 years. And I think it's important to note that we also try and source talent from elsewhere to assist our emerging trainee accountants, because what we've found with the vacancies at management level, a lot of the emerging talent is left high and dry without supervision on the ground. And our idea was to say that if we can get people who can, in the meantime, assist them, supervise them, help them grow over the 3 years, maybe by the time they complete their training, they will be ready to assume supervisory and managerial levels. And this is not a permanent commitment. It's a commitment that we've entered into for a limited period. And we hope that through that we will be able to get the talent that we need to get for our own purposes. We're also going to share some of the initiatives when we come back to discuss the strategic plan for the next year. But I think it's important also.
These people, this manages as playing a mentoring role in the sense of they themselves being possessed with this the skill for the core function, that is the auditing skill and passing it on, or are they simply HR managers? What are you referring to?
It's the first one. It's the mentoring and passing on the skill to our guys who are starting out and their training.
Okay.
And of course, as part of their job, they also are helping us in delivering on the audits. In terms of our establishment, Chair, I think we did share this slide before, but this is a slide which I think will also talk to some of the issues around the leading by example, just the spread of diversity in our office and the different levels. But it is notable here that a large number of the people that are in the Auditor General, I think it's important for the committee to note that we rely largely on the delivery that we get through our training accountants. And that's why we are giving a lot more attention to making sure that through those, if you look at the slide, for example, we've got a total of about 950 trainee accountants of a total of 2,300 staff members. These are the people that we say over a period of time, if we don't look after growing them and developing them, the office might lose in terms of future sustainable talent. Just pass that one. And so far as the vacancies, I did indicate that it's become a lot better than we where we were before. We currently, at various levels, sitting with vacancies that are less than the 500 mark. And these vacancies are spread across the whole country, in all provinces, in all the national business units. But we have focused our effort around reducing significantly the level of vacancies at management and assistant manager level, because those are the people that are responsible for the on-the-job supervision on our audits. We have taken a number of initiatives currently which are outside of this financial year we are reporting on. And because of the current environment in the country, we are also engaging with some of the firms that have got excess capacity. Because some of them, because of their business shrinking, they will not be retaining all their managers that they have. So we've started engaging with them so that we don't spend too much money trying to recruit. But if we can go to a specific firm of auditors that have got a number of people that they may not need, for example, in the future, then at least we can get them, knowing very well that they are ready and they are trained in public sector auditing, and that we don't need to spend money advertising in media and spending a lot of money trying to recruit. So this is one of the initiatives to try and reduce this, and we think that even if the vacancies do not come to 0%, but we will make a serious dent on where the vacancy levels are currently. And one more thing I think which we perhaps highlight less and less over time is the fact that part of what we also do for our mandate, we are also a training office with regards to the agreement that we have with the Institute of Chartered Accountants as well as other bodies of accountants in the country. And if you look at that particular slide, we say that there's sufficient numbers of people in our database, in our office, who have the minimum qualifications that we need to grow them. And we think that when you look at our expenditures over time, they are all geared towards trying to extract as best we can this talent and retain it. I did highlight already the ongoing vacancies, and we're doing a lot of work on that area. The pass rate in our office, I guess it's a matter which is sitting at an individual level, but we do our own bit as well to assist our staff to pass by exposing them to issues of accounting and auditing, but also assisting them with ongoing studying, because it's quite a challenge for them. While they are trying to help us deliver on our audits, they also need to be paying attention to their own development and studies. So these are the things that, from a strengthening of human resource point of view, we believe we are well-placed to get the talent that we need, even though there's a talk about skill shortages. But we think that within our environment, we can make a difference for what we have. And just to conclude on this matter with respect to where our targets were, we said we wanted to, at least at the end of the financial year, focusing on the people who are doing third year, to try and retain about 30% of those people that have qualified. Our experience, and based on the 11% staff turnover that we've highlighted, we've seen that we've exceeded that target, because there are more people who want to stay on in our office because they see that there's an opportunity for them to grow. And I think we are encouraged by this trend.
Before you leave the human resource area, the aspect that relates, that's extrinsic to yourself in terms of your overall contribution to addressing the human resource challenges of the country. You constantly hear of young graduates who are unemployed. And the big question arises as to how is that possible, especially if you take the accounting service. I would imagine that we should have a system in South Africa where by virtue of having a BCom degree, your job is effectively guaranteed, because the very fact that you've reached the stage of actually being able to complete the BCom degree, let's say BCom majoring in accounting to be specific, or auditing, I don't know much about that profession, how is it possible that you could then be languishing without a job for several years? When you are hearing Minister Shtega yesterday was talking about in the municipalities, you know, teachers and people who just know mathematics and with no accounting skills, you know, saying that those people shouldn't be there in the first place. Where are our graduates? So in a sense, I'm saying, to what extent is a government as a collective, or the public sector as a collective, making sure that we tackle this problem collectively and say, no graduate with particular skills can be left untargeted in ensuring that they do get into an opportunity where they can be have internship programs and those kind of things. To what extent is somebody coordinating a collective response broadly within the public sector, not just with government departments, but also with parastatals? Do you have a forum? Do you have something where you're coordinating your efforts? And that also brings the role of CETAs, which are supposed to be loaded with cash, to actually fund some of this. So the issue of money, to me, unless somebody tells me that it's got nothing to do with CETAs, should not be an issue, given the numbers that we hear that they're able to amass there.
Chair, I think it's a valid point that you're making in terms of mobilizing talent for the whole sector. Our focus thus far, and when we go out to various schools, I mean, recently we've been going to various provinces and doing school visits and starting to identify and encourage that talent from that level. Up to now, we haven't really collaborated with a wide range of institutions within the public sector. It's really been a focus that has been about sourcing the talent for our own needs. So I guess the point you're making could be something that could need to be evaluated perhaps with the broader other institutions, including the likes of Palama, within the public sector as a key training academy for that talent. But for our sake, we really have been saying, when we go out to engage on career engagements with various universities across the country and schools, it's always been about how do we draw talent into our own space. We haven't really expanded beyond that.
That's what I'm saying, is that we need some kind of activism around this. I come from the disability rights movement, where you don't wait for things to happen. You actually need to stimulate things to happen. Somebody must go out there and challenge systems, challenge colleagues, and say, but hang on, guys. I mean, we're complaining every day about paucity of skills, but what are we doing to make sure that as a collective, you know, no rare skill goes to waste, you know? It's like throwing away good food when there are so many people out in the street who are without food, instead of simply, after the banquet, you know, simply handing it over to the food, to the people to eat it. So I'm not necessarily directing the question at the AG as an individual office. I'm really posing it broadly to the public sector to say, we all have some role to play of an activist nature to say, let's make sure that collectively we catch this skill and not let it go to waste. That's just a general point one is making. Bill?
Thank you, Chair. I also have a question relating to HR matters, but it does also relate to salary and benefit packages, and I just want to be assured that we can ask a question like that with the media present. Okay.
We're not addressing the media.
we're addressing the
committee. It relates to page 89 of the report on the staff costs, the total packages paid to management. My question is simply whether the AG's department, AG's office applied standard percentage increases. I see some of the packages have increased considerably, others not so much. Is there a standard policy for the increase from one year to another, or are they individually negotiated year on year?
I would be inclined to say that we're supposed to, at some point, interface with REMCO, the Remuneration Committee, which is, I understand, independent of the AG's office, and which determines the salary of the AG and senior managers. I don't know how further down it goes, so that the AG does not come here and discuss his own salary or his staff salary when that matter does not reside with him in the first place, but with another body, to rather engage with that body. They've already had an informal discussion with me, and what I'm exploring is how best to introduce the matter to SCOWEC and to introduce their work as such to SCOWEC. So at an opportune time when we are ready to deal with that issue, because it's part of our work, we should be able to do that. Unless there's a specific matter that a deputy AG wants to react to. But that's how I prefer to deal with it.
I'll go along with your approach, Chair.
Just as long as we keep it on the agenda, Chair, that's fine. Thank you.
I have had lunch with the chairperson of REMCO about the last time we met. We had the telephonic discussion yesterday. We're trying to identify a date when we can meet again. And I'm interacting with the staff to look at how systematically we can deal with the issue as SCOWEC. So it's very much an issue that I'm occupied with at the point in time. And at an opportune time, we should be able to propose a process before the committee. So just bear with us a little. As soon as we're ready, we'll come back to you. But it's definitely one of the issues we will be dealing with. All right? The director of HRA. No, Mike?
Technologically challenged. Without opening the matter, I just want to give the assurance that we do follow a market-related benchmarking process for all our staff and for executives as well. But the remuneration processes for executives are handled by the chair, by REMCO, so they are handled outside of management. I just wanted to give that assurance.
So the clarity you're giving is that insofar as non-executives is concerned, that is your department section.
Yeah.
But as far as the executive, would your question be confined to non-executives? Because then maybe she would be in a position to respond. But insofar as the executives are concerned, we would then defer it for the REMCO engagement.
Yeah, Chair, my question was based on the figures that we've got here, which relate to management. So I think that is something that we need to engage REMCO with.
All right. Okay. So let's defer it on that.
Okay.
Okay. All right. AG?
I think because the question was not necessarily asked, but I just want us, Chair, to also identify that the figures referred to, whether for management executives, are figures that relate to the duration of the existence of a particular executive in 1 year. So if the figures are sort of abnormal is because someone resigned maybe at the during the course of the year, or someone joined the office during the course of the year, and in the following year someone was with the office for the full year and vice versa. So those figures will always look strange because people come and go.
Obviously, when we engage with REMCO, we could go back to the annual report on those aspects that relate directly to REMCO, such as this one. Although the main focus with REMCO actually would be going forward to look at their recommendations in terms of the remuneration of executives within the office. Going into the future, all right. Well, what I would want to emphasize though is that we are dealing with a very sensitive profession where the quality of skills and demand for skills are major challenges. And where you know, skills retention therefore becomes a critical aspect. So but I think that when we get those presentations, we'll be able to hear exactly how REMCO proposes we address those issues.
Okay.
Now, the penultimate chapter that I'm going to be dealing with now, Chair, is the funding model. I think there were questions that were raised earlier. Hopefully, if I haven't been able to cover all of them, I'm sure we'll fill the gaps, you know, once we conclude on this particular one. Two things which are just worth noting here is I think at the last engagement we had with the audit committee, one of the things they raised with the committee was the fact that we had a project that was running and initiated from the office with regard to straightening up the administration of our own finances in the organization. We had detected that there were certain things that could potentially slip back, but we managed to arrest that situation and sort it out in the time that it arose. So that's what the issue around the financial turnaround plan related to. There was nothing really extraordinary that had happened, but it was more around our regular awareness about the risks that, as an office, we need to be constantly aware. And I think it applies not only to the area of finance, it also applies to the area of human resources, where we detect that we might be exposed in certain areas from a human resource point of view. We normally would take a very concerted action around it to deal with it. So that was the focus around the financial turnaround plan, but certainly the administration of our financial environment headed by Raj Mahabir has now settled, because we've managed to also recruit people into that area who have now assumed specific responsibility for certain aspects of our financial environment. And the other one which as AG indicated earlier that we focused on was to bring the funding model of our office into a state where we say it is sustainable. And in our discussions with the committee previously, as well as with the previous committee, we did highlight what were the issues that we wanted to focus on. And I'm going to deal with some of them in this report, and so far as the funding model is concerned. Just the highlights, as reflected in our own report, in terms of what we've done. I mean, this full amount of revenue that we have generated throughout the 08-09 year is revenue that we've generated directly. And I'm answering the question that was raised earlier around the sources of funding. Our funding is exclusively, and I'm going to reflect on the exception to that, is exclusively generated from the work that we do with our auditees, whether they are municipalities, national departments, or provinces. We would bill them, and they will pay us. That's effectively what that 1.3 million, 1.3 billion comes from. And then obviously the margins that we earn from it are geared towards making sure that we can pay some of the facilities and costs that we ought to incur as an organization. These costs range from supporting our own trainee accountants in terms of their studies, as well as paying for our accommodation, among other things, and various other things that make the Auditor General as an institution exist in all 9 provinces and nationally. We're not positioned to make profits as an office. However, where we have an opportunity to have a surplus, it is always something that is welcome because it assists us in making sure that we can continue to finance certain things like acquisition of fixed assets, computers, and the renewal of old fixed assets that will help us operate as an office. So this income statement and these financial highlights are not driven by profit considerations, but they are driven by the desire to earn a margin so that we can pay for the things that make this office tick. Currently,
can you just educate me in terms of accounting? Because my basic arithmetic would tell me that where you have a net deficit, or which I suppose would be, well, I wouldn't call it a loss, would basically cancel out any possible net profit or surplus. How do you have a surplus and a deficit at the same time?
Oh, sorry, Chair. The surplus that I'm referring to is a conceptual. I was making a conceptual statement with respect to, because in the Public Audit Act, the Public Audit Act specifically says that where the office has made a surplus, and I'm now in theoretical space now because the surplus hasn't materialized.
Right.
Where the office makes a surplus, it must bring that surplus into SCOWEC so that SCOWEC can engage with the office as to what must happen with that surplus. Now, the current situation we're in is a deficit situation. We do not have a surplus, we've got a deficit. Effectively,
because I heard you saying gross profit, you don't actually make profit, but that would refer to a surplus per se. And then I thought, but
that is before you incur all the expenses. If you read further down,
all right,
we then have the expenses that we incurred, which are our accommodation, our technology costs, our costs of various things, which then take us to a number that is a negative. That's why we've got a 16.
So that is gross.
That's gross, yes. That's the...
And the other one is net. That's where they...
The first one is the sweat.
Ah.
The first one, the 306257, and then this one is after we've paid for all other things, after we've sweat at delivering the audits.
All right, all right. I studied law. I didn't study accounting or mathematics. So.
All right. Okay. And then just one thing I think I need to, it's important to highlight. There are two methods that we use in the office to generate the revenue that we generate. Part of it is when we say own hours revenue, we are referring to all the people that we employ in the office, in the audit business. Over the past year, that is the 2009 year, we've generated the amount of about 824 million from that source. And the other one is the private audit firms that help us deliver on these audits, which is to the extent of the 551 million. That's what that 1.3 billion has come from our own hours, which is our people, as well as the firms that we employ. I think what is important to highlight here is that on our own hours, because we are basing our tariffs, and we are going to discuss the tariffs as well when we come up again with the strat plan, I think next week, but on our own hours, that is where we earn a margin. So if effectively we've got a staff member that we are charging out at R1,000, we earn a margin from that staff member, for example, if we pay them, let's say, 630. The difference of 370 is the gross profit that we earn from the services of that person. Whereas if the same work is given to a private audit firm, and the private audit firm says, we can do this work for you for 1,000 rands, we collect that 1,000 rands on their behalf from the auditee and give it to them as 1,000 rands. And I think that's the issue that we picked up when we discussed the funding model, when we said we are going to go away and engage with that issue, so that for the work that we do, at least we must be able to get something for it.
That then doesn't cover your overhead.
Absolutely.
You're just a conduit, and you don't pay yourself for delivery services.
Absolutely. And that's why on this slide, Chair, I mean, just to illustrate the point, if you look at the gross profit percentage on own hours revenue, that is the 37 that I was talking about, in making the illustration between 1,000 rand and 630, what was left with us was the 370, if you like, which is 37%. Now, that gross profit which we earn in our own hours, because we are getting nothing for the work that we are giving out to private audit firms, the overall gross profits, when we add up the revenue from contract work and from our own hours, becomes less than what that 37 was, because for the rest of the other revenue that we earn, there's no margin on it. So that was the crux of this funding model, among other things, because
I hope it's not worse than that, in the sense that you don't end up paying more than you get charged. Well, how do I put it? You don't have a situation where the auditee pays 1,000 and the auditing firm gets paid 1,200. In other words, where you then are left with an outright deficit as such, because that would be even worse.
No, the worst case scenario is zero. Yeah. Even if you look at our financial statements, that 551, 621, which is revenue, is exactly the same as the outflow, which is the cost of auditing by private audit firms. So we make sure that the worst case scenario on this one is zero. So the issue that we engaged with respect to the funding model was to say this overall 22% for the period ending March 2009 was not sustainable. And the reason it was not sustainable was because of the capping, and we spoke at length about the capping at the previous meeting on the funding model, of capping the increases for the top level of staff at about 4% on an ongoing basis. So we've removed that, and the results for the 2009-2010 year will reflect an improvement on this gross profit percentage of 22%. Currently, if I may share with the committee, since we started the new financial year after we implemented the revised funding model, we are currently up to the end of June, I think, for the first quarter of the year. We are currently in the 30s with regards to that overall percentage, which means that the ability of the office to continuously sustain its funding is improving. But we obviously will reflect on that when the financial year that we are in now comes to an end. But we believe that with the correction that was made to the funding model for the new period, the gross profit percentage has improved. Now, one of the issues, I think, with respect to the 16 million loss that we are showing, it is a loss after we have done a number of things. One of them is we also got support from National Treasury to the extent of 90 million. A portion of it, to the extent of about 53, has been put into this income statement. So it has helped us in a way to get the loss that we have up to about 16 million deficit currently. So I think it's important to note that we have had support, which was a once-off support. It's not a continuous support that we are going to be asking for all the time. It was linked to our submission of the funding model. We said, because we've been struggling with our margins over the last couple of years, we've lost the opportunity to replace some of the things that we need to replace over time, and we, with the assistance of COEC, got assistance specifically a once-off assistance which was not going to recur, and we reflected on it in the notes to the financial statements that are audited, and that was the only other source of funding that we got which helped us get a loss of about $16 million. The 90 million is in the annual report. We got an injection from National Treasury beginning of the ones of financial support. The one we're dealing with now, it is 2008-09. We received it in January, so it's part of the period up to the end of March 2009. To augment us from a cash flow point of view. Yeah. Are there any questions so far in respect of the funding? I'm going to deal with the data.
We've dealt with the HR. We've now dealt with the funding. Are there any colleagues that want to zoom into the funding model? We had some chats earlier in the year. Clearly, the issue of the tariff that applies with regard to outsourcing is a problem because it does not cover overheads and basically the financial implications of actually administering that external resource. What do you propose? Have you proposed anything specific in this regard? And just what is the rate of the outsourced service vis-a-vis the rate of your own, how does it compare with your own rate in terms of your own internal resources?
On the issue of the rate, Chair, that's why we said at the last engagement that we had on the funding model, we said we wanted to go and just do an analysis on these numbers, including the rates, because what is clear is that if, let's take an example, if a private audit firm is going to do work for, let's take an example, if they are going to do work for Woolworths and they put in their staff on the audit of Woolworths, the chances are that they are going to get an average rate per hour with all their senior people and junior people combined. They are going to get an average rate per hour, let's say, of 1,000 rand. With us, the rate is substantially lower than that. It might sit at about 550, for example. So already when we engage the private audit firms, we are basically engaging with them on a rate that is substantially lower than a rate they would have got if they put their resources onto a Woolworths audit. So there's that trade-off as well.
That rate is still higher than the rate that you would charge if it was using your own internal resources to provide the service. Is that correct? In other words, if this outside audit firm audited Woolworths, that is nothing to do with the AG's office, they probably would have charged 2,000 an hour. But when they are engaged by the AG's office, they charge 1,000 rand an hour. But if the AG was using his own staff, they'd probably charge 500 rand an hour. Is that a correct configuration or conceptualization of this, or am I missing it altogether?
Shilin, do you want to come in there?
Chair, you put it very succinctly. That's exactly what the situation is. The differential between our charge to auditees versus the agreed rates for work done on our behalf is 30% differential.
That is still lower than what they would charge private companies, the private sector, in the main market. Now, how sustainable is this? well, what is the reaction of the auditees? Don't you get resistance sometimes?
Absolutely, there is. There's no doubt, Chair, there is resistance. And that's why when we engaged with this issue, we said there were some community members who said, no, but you can't do this work for nothing. But it's not technically for nothing, because even though we're not showing a profit in our books, but we are getting this work done on our behalf on a rate that is substantially lower than what the normal market rate is. They do have a challenge with this, but we've got a forum where we negotiate what the tariffs are going to be per hour. And because of the toing and froing, we ultimately come to a view with them that says, for now we can work with the rates that we have. But certainly I think the point that we've taken from this discussion was to say, is there a scope for us to want to add an additional recovery for ourselves, even though we know that we are giving them a rate that is slightly lower than what they would get elsewhere. So that's the point that we have said we're going to come back to you on to determine whether there is scope for us to charge a cost to recover our auditors' overheads. And we haven't done that exercise yet.
Obviously, you have to charge a rate that is fair, but what is fair is a big question. It's fair because you are making a reasonable recovery of your own cost, or is it fair because you are applying a universal charge for the service, irrespective whether it's done in-house or through the use of external auditors. So the question of what is fair price, becomes a bit of a tricky issue in this context. But then it also brings the other issues around appropriate levels of staffing within the AG's office, because if the AG, through the use of its own staff, is able to bring the price of auditing down, well, naturally the inclination would be, well, load yourself with as many accountants as you can and do much of the work in-house. But then you may argue that there are other considerations that necessitate the bringing in of external skill, and we may need to zoom back into those and say, how pertinent and how critical are those vis-a-vis the general imperative of keeping the cost of doing business, well, the cost, the profit, well, the price down, purely to make the service more affordable. I mean, I'm looking at the problem of backlog, especially at the level of municipality. I assume that you are not actually using, especially with the small municipalities, even beginning to imagine yourself using the external auditors, because if they can't even pay you, you obviously can't even think of letting them pay R1,000 an hour when you could actually be making them pay R500 an hour through the use of your own internal auditors. So I'm just saying those issues are arising, and they may need you to really succinctly clarify them so that, you know, even for the auditees, they are happy that they are not unnecessarily being overcharged, if you like.
With respect to the first point, the determination of the tariffs, we do it via a process where we get submissions for example, the pay levels of the different people that they put on our audits, together with an indication of what type of overheads they incur, you know, to be able to support us. So in arriving at that rate, we've got a model that I think at an appropriate time, and maybe when we discuss the tariffs with the strategic plan, we can also maybe share with the committee as to how we arrive at the rates, at those tariffs. So I think that probably will help in terms of just clarifying in the eyes of the committee once we come through with the rates. Because the rates and the tariffs that we are going to be applying for the next year, which go with the strategic plan, are going to be an item for engagement with the committee the next session we're going to have.
But can I just ask a very general question? Is it so that in determining where you're going to use external auditors as opposed to internal auditors, you take into account the financial muscle, one, and two, the complexity of the financial processes of the auditee concerned, so that, for example, you don't overload a poor municipality in Brussels-Fontein or something with a very expensive auditor who comes from Johannesburg, as opposed to, say, for example, some parastatal that is a multi-billion concern, which may have a much more sophisticated operation and which may justify a sophisticated level of audit. I'm just saying, are those considerations ever coming into play in determining whether to use external or internal, and the level of expertise that goes into the team, selecting the team that you're going to use?
Chair, that point is clearly within the purview of the auditing standards that we apply, and I'm sure when we deal with the issue of auditing standards, it will probably arise as well, where we say in order to decide the level of skill and expertise required to perform a particular audit, you need to take into account the risk factors in that audit. You need to take into account even issues of distance. For example, if I can use an example that keeps coming up in a business unit like the Northern Cape, our office in the Northern Cape is based only in Kimberley. But because of the vastness of that province, they also would be expected to go and do an audit in the furthest place, for example, in Springbok. Now, the cost of those people having to travel by road, for example, is a practical example, from Kimberley to the furthest point in the Northern Cape, comes into the equation as a matter of fact, because they would normally have to spend 4 hours on the road trying to get there. And there's also, FMT costs that come with it. So when we look at all our portfolios, we then say, what is the best possible person to do this job, considering the risk factor? Because when those people travel from Kimberley, because naturally they would stay in Kimberley, now you've also got to leave, they're going to stay there for the whole week. So you've got to put out with some costs for keeping them in a hotel for the week and all of that. So in that context, we then look at the risk and say, what level of expertise is required to do this audit? And if we're happy that an ordinary firm that is there can do it, without having to pay for hotel and transport and all of the things to get to Springbok, we would then look at it and say maybe the best option is to give it to that audit firm that is based there, so that we don't burden the auditee with the extra cost. But in some situations, it's not always easy, because you might find that in that town where that municipality is, there's not even an audit firm that you can rely on. Maybe there is an accounting firm which is run by one partner with two staff members. From a risk management point of view, we may take a view that says, even if the cost from a rent point of view is going to be higher, but the reputation risk of giving this job to that one-man show in that town is a lot higher than the cash cost of paying for people to go stay there for a week from our own office and go to it. It is a combination of factors, but it's driven largely by considerations of risk management as well as what is the best possible answer to that outsourcing arrangement. So when we do it in due consideration of those factors.
Obviously, as you correctly said, we will zoom into, in terms of going forward, a deeper discussion into what is the appropriate funding model. Or if you like, pricing model. I could already upfront envisage a situation where cross-subsidization in its broader context is completely inevitable, because we mustn't lose focus of what your primary mandate is. Your primary mandate is not profit maximization like a private company. Your performance indicators are based on producing the best possible information or audit outcomes possible within reason in terms of the cost that goes into achieving that. So we mustn't compromise that because of wanting to make sure that from a cost point of view, financial sustainability is critical. In other words, I think it's because you're a public entity, you perform a public function. Issues of financial considerations would be different to those of a private company where profit maximization is the imperative.
Just to close out on this point, Chair, maybe just one further illustrative example. And mainly, this is probably something that happens in municipalities largely. If you look at and we're going to deal now with the issue of the outstanding debt and the long outstanding debt, there are situations where when you look at a municipality in terms of its income base, in terms of its extent of activities and the size of the municipality, especially in the very deep, remote areas, the fact that you've got to go there becomes costly. But once you arrive there, it's possible that out of a five day week, the productive work that is possibly going to be done there is probably maybe an equivalent of a day or two in a week. Now, the pricing of the audit when you do the budget is based on the best possible scenario. You don't know at the planning stage if the finance manager and the manager for this, that, and the other, suddenly when you arrive there, are going to be missing in action, for example. Now, the reality is you are out there in Port Nolan.
Find a teacher in that municipality for that.
Absolutely.
So they have not prepared financial statements, but have prepared notes for a classroom.
Absolutely.
Scenario. But anyway.
Yeah, so the dilemma then becomes, shall we go back all the way, or shall we stick it out and hope that this person will be there tomorrow? So there are all of those things which then lead to
the issue. Reconstruct their books somehow, because they can write their own books possibly.
Yeah,
it's a dilemma. I guess.
But it makes auditing interesting. That's why auditing is interesting, and that's why the people that are here are so interesting as auditors, because they have to deal with all those challenges which are.
But law is the most interesting subject.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. So just to conclude on this matter, this is just a comparison to what we budgeted for when we did our budget. The strat plan for the 08-09, we obviously have experienced up to the end of this last financial year the need to have moved a lot of our work towards contract work, and that's why you see those differences between the budget. But on the bottom line, we obviously have not really spent a lot of the resources, and we've ended up with a 16 million deficit. After having planned to close this particular year from a budget point of view on 8.3 surplus. Then the large portion of that, as I said, if you look at the contract work line, it's a lot higher than what we had budgeted for in terms of actual experience. So that's really where the key thing is. These variables between what you get in terms of your surplus line are predominantly sticky around the combination of contract work and own hours, and that's what's really driving largely our funding model. And I'm sure it's going to come apparent as well with the engagement on the strat plan. And I think it's going to be one of the key issues fundamentally that drive our funding model for the future, because what comes out at the bottom line is largely a factor of what combination of contract work and own hours are you planning to achieve. On the cost control side, we're currently looking at initiatives now to start paying a lot more attention on our own expenses. That is the expenses on travel,
the expenses on accommodation and various other aspects that are overhead costs. And we are busy with a program on, in the office to drive that particular initiative. And we've already started implementing some of the very practical and easy initiatives. For example, you will not find any of us in business class when we come here, unless SAA has been generous to upgrade us from an economy ticket, which sometimes we will not say no to, as long as we're not paying for it. So that's really our income statement. So we think that we also have put in a number of disciplines to make sure that we don't unnecessarily commit the office to expenditures that it cannot sustain. If you can just pass that one. I've spoken about the sources of revenue. I think it's been clearly articulated. And this one is really just a highlight to say that a large number of costs that we incur, if you look at quantum, from a quantum point of view, is predominantly contract work and recoverable staff cost. The rest of it is really the support machinery that we use in the office. So if one looks at where the bulk of these resources go, it goes towards the people who do the work and who are delivering on our mandate. That's really what that slide is trying to illustrate.
I wouldn't have raised my eyebrows if you were traveling, if your executives were traveling business class. I mean, given all the traveling that probably has to happen.
Yeah, not to happen.
Like really.
On that point, I mean, we try and reach a stage where we say, for as long as we have an element of flexibility in terms of, you know, being able to move from one flight to another. Mm-hmm. But we are also sensitive to the current economic environment, as it were, and also the perception that comes with it. You might find that the rent difference is nothing to write home about, but I think we're always out there preaching certain things, but we want to be the last people to be seen to be doing the opposite, among other things. So we've actually comfortably agreed among ourselves that that's what we will do.
Now, as long as you people are comfortable in the economy,
I've spoken about the cost containment exercise and the target that we are busy building on now to make sure that whatever drives our costs is what we can sustain going forward. On the cash flow side, if it were not for the injection from National Treasury, we probably would have ended with a net decrease in cash and cash equivalents for this year, but we were helped by the injection that came from National Treasury. And at that time, one of the things that was straining our environment from a cash flow point of view was that when we started the 2009 year, which is the calendar year, beginning of the year, a lot of our NFMA audits were completed around December, and there was a huge amount of money that we were owing to most audit firms that helped us deliver on this result. And we were very grateful that we had National Treasury assisting us in that regard, because it was at a point when there was a huge concentration of our own money that was owing by municipalities where we were having this cash flow crunch. So when the money came in from National Treasury, it helped, among other things, to get us to pay those private audit firms that helped us deliver. And then if I step straight into the debtor situation, you will note on this slide that in the 120 and above line as at the end of March, the biggest balance outstanding overall in the system was about 53 million, which is the 12.4 plus the 41 million. That's what was owing to us at the end of the financial year by various institutions. But the most significant of all is within the area of municipalities, which is about 32 million. The question was raised, what are you doing about this? We are consistently engaging the municipalities. We've even elevated this issue to the level of the premiers in those three provinces where this amount is concentrated. It's largely within the Northern Cape, the Eastern Cape, and Northwest. We've initiated a process with the Minister for Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. He's undertaken to work with us and assist us with recovering that money. But there are a lot of complex issues here from a legislation point of view in terms of whether you can pay from the center on behalf of municipalities and all of that. But we're trying. We haven't given up. But the reality is that this is largely a strain to us because it's monies that are owing over long periods of time. On the current side, big numbers, but I think if one looks at what was then in the books at 31 March and now, quite a substantial portion of that would have been recovered by now. But I think it is worth noting that payment of our outstanding audits or audit fees is still a problem within the area of municipalities.
Chair, can I interrupt, please?
Yeah.
Can I just know why there's a difference between the figure on the slide, 323 million, and the figure in the report of 272 million on page 55?
This one is also obviously before the provision for impairment. It's at page 55. It's 55.
The same date, Chair, 31st of March 2009.
I've got to look at another table here. This one netted off with the provision. So the provision of doubtful debts, which would have netted this, but I just want to double check what the difference would be if one strips that out.
Perhaps want to flag it and...
Yeah, I'll ask the CFO to just quickly check that
right.
And see if you can reconcile that all back right. With the provision taken out. But,
all right, we'll flag it and come back to
you. Okay. We'll come back on that one, Chair, before we conclude. On the trade payables, I did indicate that there was a slight hitch at the beginning of the year, but a lot of the monies that we're owing to our contract creditors by now have largely been resolved. There probably are just a few that are still outstanding now, which are to do with queries that are there on their invoices. And so far as the challenges are concerned, I did say that we've now started monitoring and controlling very closely our overheads and contract work, and we've also started monitoring the impact of the revised funding model where we lifted the cap on our tariffs. So that one is a continuing issue. It's part of our top 10 risks that we've identified, which are regularly shared with the audit committee. However, the one that I've just dealt with now, which is the declining working capital, I think is another focus area which we will continue to deal with to make sure that we collect our cash as quickly as we can so that we can be able to pay our creditors. That is generally, Chair, the position with respect to the funding of the office, and I think if one extracts the key issues going forward is to consistently make sure that from a margin point of view, the tariffs as well as our debtors and working capital. If we can pay particular attention to those areas, we will continue to have the resources that we need to have to be able to pay the people that do the audits, as well as to pay our creditors who support us in achieving our mandate. And that, I think, is what largely the objective of our funding ought to be about, and that's what we utilize the funds that we generate towards. And that ends the part on the funding model. I'm not sure if there's any questions that we need to deal with before we move to the last chapter.
You know, when you commented about economy class tickets, I paused for a moment and I thought it's well and good to talk about, living within our means, and making sure that we cut out on
unnecessary expenses. But I think it's also important not to take things to the extreme, and I'm just making a general point without reference to this specific item, to say that we must remember that the issue of independence and credibility of this office is the most critical issue. And the last thing we want is to be so lean and mean in our expenses that we starve ourselves so much that we make ourselves vulnerable to all kinds of attractive offers out there, all kinds of gifts that might come our way with the intention to influence the way we see things. So I'm just saying it's good to have that kind of principle. But as the economists say, on the other hand, we need to guard against making working for the AG's office so unattractive, or attractive in a different way, where people may be attracted to the office not so much because of the benefits that the office itself offers, but because they are well positioned to source benefits from elsewhere by virtue of being in the office. So I really, when we get to the funding model, would resist the attitude that says, let's be lean and mean. We should be, but to a point. You know, I would rather, you know, err on the side of saying, let's provide appropriately, resource appropriately, so that we safeguard the independence of the office. It's just a general point to make.
So Mr. Steele's question on the difference in the in the in the debtors, the one you picked up on page 55, I think what we did here, we probably just took an extract of the major categories of debtors, and if you look at it, you should take comfort on page 96 of the report, which reflects exactly the amount that we show on the slide, 323,305. If you look at the audit report, the audit report includes the schedules that are sitting on page 96, whereas what is on page 55, based on what we present outside of what the auditors are reporting on, is probably an extract of the major categories that you are drawing attention to. So that's why the difference. But I think you should be comfortable that what has been audited is exactly the slide of 323,305, which is on page 96.
Makes sense, James, too?
Yeah, can I just confirm then? So the figure of 323 million is in fact what we need to be worrying about.
Yeah. Well, that's the audited number. It's part of the notes to the financial statements.
So we resolve that one? Satisfied? All right. We're done with this section. Now we're going to the last section now.
Yes. And the last section, Chair, as AG has indicated earlier, deals with how we manage our own risks, which is the risks around our own environment, the issue around our BEE strategy, as well as whether we are on track in achieving our employment equity. And we think that largely these areas we've substantially made progress and achieved what we had set out to achieve on this. If I just want to point something which maybe links to the point that the Chair has just made before I commented on the data thing, is the implementation of our ethics and independence policies. We think that from an operational risk point of view, that's one of the things that we are gearing ourselves for. We've developed and updated an existing program that we have in the office to make sure that there's transparency and disclosure is necessarily required for people who do the kind of work that we do. So we want to make sure that insofar as this is concerned, we are at least seen among the people who lead by example, because we want to be proactive in making sure that any potential conflicts that we might have are addressed proactively. On the allocation of work, if I look at the allocation of work to the different firms, being the audit work allocation, we've established a target over a period of time where we split up our resources between the different categories of firms, and we stick to that process where we allocate work to various firms on the basis of their strengths, on the basis of their deliverables, as well as on the basis of their quality considerations that we take into account in the work allocation. And we think that quite a number of the industry players in the private sector have a fair chance of getting work allocated from our office. We do this once in a two-year cycle with very clear rules and processes in place to administer this, which is handled by our tender committee. On the transformation front, if I look at the split of responsibilities in the office, certainly between the demographic profile of the people that we have in our office, there are differences depending on various offices, but I think largely the office has given specific attention to that area, and we believe that we are not going to depart from the equity profile of the office going forward. In conclusion, Chair, the issues that I've just pulled up in the slides on these different chapters of our strategic plan are continuing to be our areas of focus. And when we come back to discuss the strategic plan and the budget, which we'll be presenting, as I understand, on the 16th, will largely be revolving around these issues. And I think we will continue to build on what we've achieved in the past year to ensure that the mandate of the office, as well as the commitments that the AG has made to Parliament, continue to be driven with the level of intensity that we've seen happening in the past year. And on that note, I would like to once again thank the Chair for the opportunity. I think we have done what we believe was required of us. We still have some areas where we need to improve, and we believe that the challenges that are there are not insurmountable. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's quite a mouthful. Mr. Judge, you want to kick off?
Thank you, Chair. On the risk issues, on page number 55, it makes reference to gains, foreign exchange gains. They obviously are in the financials. Is there any risk for foreign exchange losses? Unlikely, but I just want to ask the question. And then on page number 78, there's a reference to staff debtors, which has increased from last year, from 5 million to 6 million. And there was an instance in a previous year where monies had to be written off for ex-staff members who didn't pay the debt back, I think. So what risk mitigation is in place there? Because the debtor book is growing. And then on the stolen notebooks, it looks like there were more stolen this year than the previous year. So, you know, why would that be the case? Thank you, Chairperson.
What are the stolen notebooks? Stationery. Oh, laptops.
Yeah, laptops. Yes, notebook laptops, yeah.
That's a bunch of things. They tend to be freely distributed at conferences and everywhere. All right. You want to respond?
Forex, risk on forex losses. The only area where we earn fees in dollars is obviously the work that we do for the United Nations. And that one is not a significant risk exposure there, because depending on the flow of currencies in a one-year cycle, we think that it is limited, because there's no other work that we do outside of the UN. And the amounts that we get from the work we do at the UN are pre-approved from an amount point of view. So we already know, even before the full financial year kicks in, how much work is going to come out from the UN and what has been approved by the UN Board of Auditors. So the fluctuations of interest on that amount are not significant by any stretch of the imagination. So it's not only the movements in the currency, but I think it's contained. On the issue of the staff debtors, when I referred earlier to...
This is something you wouldn't be able to do much about. I mean, if the rent, we wouldn't be suggesting any hedging like SAA. The rent has since been able to hold its own. But I'm just saying, you do work, you get paid at an agreed time. So there isn't much you can do about that. Mm-hmm. You can only, unless it's a particular issue that arises there.
I mean, from an exchange rate differential, it wouldn't be a huge amount. If the rent goes the other way, we might end up with a loss, yes, but I think it's not one of those huge losses that one would warrant to have hedging around. Staff debtors. One of the things that we put in place when we did a review of our finance turnaround plan was to keep close watch over the outstanding amounts owing by staff. And a lot of them have to do with giving staff advances. So when staff go out on a long audit for a long period of time, we advance them the amount for things like accommodation and so on. So most of the time, these amounts are amounts where the staff have not necessarily borrowed from us, but we've advanced them the amount to use while they are out there in those audits that are in far-flung places. And sometimes it takes longer for them to bring it back. Sometimes they bring back the normal receipts to substantiate the expenditure quickly. So that's what that staff debtors is. It's not loans predominantly. It's predominantly advances, because many of them wouldn't be able to go and do these audits on our behalf if we didn't advance them cash. But we've got proper control over it. In fact, what is instituted as a control now is to say, if we have given an advance and we haven't come back with documentation within 60 days of getting that disbursement, we will be entitled to recover it from your salary. So that's the control that we have put in place. Raj, how many notebooks did we lose?
Apparently, Mr. Stowe's report is missing about 8 pages. Can we arrange that a better copy be made available to him so that he can perform his oversight function? At which page?
Is that page there?
It's the one that's got page 68. Dr. George has got a version that's got a page 68. Mine doesn't.
All right. Or is it just the one page? But the rest of the pages are there.
Yeah, it's 64 to 73 that I'm missing.
So it's about 8 pages. All right. The offering to swap.
Must just check those ones to see if there's not.
You've got enough pay. Yeah, we must just do some quality assurance there. Your printer has failed you there. All right.
As a CFO, we're just going to give a comment on the notebooks.
Yeah.
All right.
Chair, as far as the issue of the stolen notebooks are concerned, we've done a feasibility study in terms of insuring a theft of notebooks, and it turned out to be extremely expensive and therefore financially unviable. So whenever we have notebooks being stolen, we write it, we expense it to income. Of course, the nature of our business is such that we have our staff in all parts of the country at all times, traveling in all modes of transport as well. And this generally then results in the kind of losses we endure on notebooks. However, we have got very stringent internal controls. So when a theft is reported, there's generally a need for an affidavit, a proper interrogation process before the loss is admitted as an AGSA loss on the books.
What numbers of notebooks are we talking about?
I don't have it on me, Chair, but it would be basically the amount written off divided by 18,000 rand. I think it's about 500,000, Dr. George, that was written off, right?
263,000
divided by 18,000. And that would represent about 14 to 15.
Notebooks.
Yeah.
And this is on an operation of how many on average?
There's about over 2,000 employees with notebooks. So.
All right.
So it's not a significant number proportionately.
Well, certainly compared to having to take up insurance for all of them, that would be even much more costly. My understanding is that insurance for notebooks tends to be much higher anyway. So, yeah. I once had my laptop stolen from my house, which was locked, and somebody broke into the house. And Parliament never wanted to replace it. I fought and screamed, but to no avail. All right. Any further questions in this regard? So, are we moving towards wrapping up? I think that there's a number of areas that would be followed up in relation to other areas of our work. For example, the area of issues around the pricing model or the funding model, vis-à-vis the strat plan discussions that we're going to be having as well, remuneration issues that are still raised, where REMCO is still going to come back to us, and the key thing is just to make sure that the program of the committee has already catered for all those issues. So that would be the basis on which we move. I don't know if there are any other areas that we would want to have specific focus on, dedicated meetings on, apart from those that I've spoken. We have scheduled, I can't remember when the program of our committee says we're going to do the provincial visits, and I don't know how far we are in terms of preparations because the committee secretary has been deployed elsewhere, so we don't have the benefit of a progress report on that. But certainly there are issues that we have highlighted which we will take up or will take forward in other structures or processes of Parliament. Around the oversight function, for example, of Parliament as an institution. But certainly when we write our report as a committee, in our recommendations, in our findings, I think we shouldn't lose some of those issues. So I hope the committee secretary and from your side, your staff, have noted some of these issues so that we don't lose them. On that note, I just want to also thank members for coming to support us at APEC. Obviously, APEC was the audit committee.